Let's go back to Genesis chapter 42. We're in the middle of a section that's it's rather elongated. We'll just take chapter 42 as we deal with the passage today. Verse 1, when Jacob learned that there was a grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" He said, "Behold, I've heard that there's grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us, that we may live, not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where did you come from?" he said. And they said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them, and he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." And he said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We are your servants, our 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this, and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households. And bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. He returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. As one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack." At this, their hearts failed them, and they turned, trembling, to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" When they came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man, the lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, 'We are honest men. We've never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the lord of the land, said to us, 'By this I shall know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me and take grain for the famine of your households and go your way. Bring your youngest brother to me. Then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men. I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land.' And as they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. Jacob, their father, said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me.' Then Reuben said to his father, Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you. But Jacob said, My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. Most of us aren't ordinarily patient. We get upset when the guy in front of us is driving slower than we are, even if that speed happens to even be above the speed limit. Don't you hate that? How about stoplights? You ever just been sitting at a stoplight, getting a little more irritated as another car goes through, another car goes through? How about the last time you had to sit in a waiting room? One patient goes, another one comes after you've already been in there, and they go in before you. You're like, what's going on? I got the wrong number today. Sometimes the wait seems to be more than we can bear. Like the time when you were a kid and you showed up at the amusement park and everybody got to go on the roller coaster except you because you didn't meet the line and you thought you would never grow tall enough to go on the roller coaster. Maybe there was the time when as a kid you lost your front tooth and mom brought out the corn on the cob. You're like, what? Really? The only time I get to eat this and my tooth is gone. But it's not just kids who can hardly wait. How about that mother-in-law who can't wait for that first grandbaby? The process of waiting the results of an interview. Sometimes maybe it's a medical test. We all struggle with waiting. One of my favorite lines from an old John Wayne movie comes at the point as the plot is thickening. A young restless cowboy is riding beside an old weathered cowboy. And he asks him how he can be so patient as they wait for the action to begin. The old cowboy's reply is rather classic. I like what he says because it just doesn't really fit in a Western if you think about it. He turns to the young cowboy and he says, Son, I've got the patience of an oyster. Oysters are pretty good examples of the fact that God isn't in a hurry. Listen to how a pearl is made. A natural pearl begins its life as a foreign object, either a parasite or a piece of shell or sand that accidentally lodges itself in an oyster's soft inner body where it can't be expelled. To ease this irritant, the oyster's body takes defensive action, beginning to secrete a smooth, hard, crystalline substance around the irritant in order to protect itself. This substance is called nacre. As long as the irritant remains within the body, the oyster will continue to secrete nacre around it, layer upon layer, and over time, the irritant will be completely encased by the silky crystalline coatings. The result, ultimately, is the lovely, lustrous gem that we call a pearl. But this doesn't happen in days, it doesn't happen in weeks, it doesn't happen in months. This happens over the period of years. I think one of the most difficult things for us to wait for in life is for a life to get right with God. Whether it's our own life or somebody else's life that we love, we've invested in, we've been watching, we've been waiting, we've been praying for. But like the oyster and the pearl, God's work on a man's conscience may be slow, but it proves to be an effective grace. That's our proposition this morning. There's going to be four ways that we're going to look at in which God gets man's attention through conscience. The first one we find in the first five verses. God gets our attention by removing our comfort and our security. God gets our attention by removing our comfort and our security. The method that he uses in this instance is the famine. He uses the famine at this point to get their attention. It says at the end of the previous chapter, 41 verse 57, it says the famine was severe in all the earth. We see down in verse 5 in this chapter that the famine is in the land of Canaan. Things are going along in Jacob's life, in the life of Jacob's sons, and it seems like nothing's ever going to happen as far as getting right with God. The sons have traded off Joseph. They've sold him into slavery. It's been some 20, 22 years at this point. And there's still this tension. There's this unresolved sin in their lives, and yet they represent the people of the blessing. They represent the people that God has wanted to use to be a blessing to others. And yet there's this rift, not just between them
and their brothers, but because of the way they've treated their brother, there's also a rift between them and God. And for years, this has gone on. But God, at this point in the story, begins to move things forward. And the way he does it is by removing from them their comfort, removing from them their security. The result of this is that they experience fear and self-preservation. In verse 1, we have it in the ESV here, and most English translations have it the same way. Jacob says to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" Different languages have different things that happen. Like when we have the word didn't, D-I-D-N, we put apostrophe T, we drop the O. Sometimes in Hebrew, which has very many words that are made out of three of their consonants, when one of the consonants drops out, you're left with two letters, and you're trying to figure out what this word comes from that the rest of the word is built on. Probably this word is the word for fear rather than the word to see. It's probably better translated, "Why are you fearing for yourselves?" rather than, "Why do you sit there staring at one another?" This idea of fear is going to play prominently into this story. They're operating by fear. God is removing their comfort. He's removing their security. God has them now between a rock and a hard spot. And you know, sitting there staring at one another is a fine way to translate it, especially if it's off the different word, which means to see. But the idea is they're left at such a spot in life where they're inactive. They're unable to do anything. They're not able to move forward. They can't go to the right. They can't go to the left. Jacob says, you know what, the only way that we have to deal with this problem is to go to where there's food. But don't be undone by where you find yourself in life. It's time to start moving. It's time to start to take action. And when we do that by ourselves, oftentimes we take the wrong action. But God, we see in this story, is moving them to take the right actions. Of their own accord, they're moving God's direction. This is an important point because we each have free will. We can do what we want, but God is bigger than us, and He tends to be able to steer us using the choices that we make, both good choices and bad choices. And God, at this point, takes away their ability to have the status quo at place in their life. They've got to make a choice. And God, just like the psalmist says, is before him and behind him. And God comprehends his ways. And God is like a shepherd, moving them, forcing them to make choices in this story. And that's what they do. Jacob learns that there's grain in Egypt. It says in verse 1, the only source of their help at this moment is in a direction that they themselves wouldn't have chosen to look. Guys, the only place that we can get food is down in Egypt where there happens to be food. I mean, that's kind of simple when you stop and think about it. But where's the last place they want to look or go for help? Down to Egypt. For the obvious reason that 20 years ago they sent their younger brother down there. Egypt doesn't mean good things for them. Egypt brings up bad memories for them. Egypt, don't want to go down there. But God steers them the one direction that they wouldn't have chosen to go. Jacob says in verse 2, "Go down, buy grain for us that we may live and not die." Now we're going to see that Jacob is a man who's kind of given to hyperbole once in a while. But Joseph also later on in the story is going to recognize that this famine is grave in nature. You have two choices. Either you eat or you die. I mean, it's pretty simple. God grabs these people by the throat. He pulls the rug out from underneath them and says, "Now listen, you've got to make a choice. I'm putting you into a position where you don't like it, but here are your options. You either go get some food or you're going to die." I mean, don't you love it when God makes life simple for us? It's either this choice or it's that choice. And that's all we're left with. And that's where they're at. And God gives them the obvious choice, and they make the right choice. Verse 4, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, lest some harm might befall him. Whether he said it out loud or just thought it, the idea is, behind the word harm, lest he experiences a fatal accident. Jacob is thinking, in sending Benjamin, if I send Benjamin with these guys, maybe Benjamin will die. And he starts to pull back in self-preservation. Guys, go get food. We got to take care of this problem. This problem's big. We've got to solve it. We've got to provide. Nothing wrong with that, but we don't see any reference to God in this whole scenario. Nonetheless, God is working behind the scenes. You know, God has many ways of getting our attention by removing our comfort and our security. When you look at the global situation today, you know, those two things are kind of unique to this corner of the globe, aren't they? The fact that we get to pursue comforts. God takes away my comfort, He gets my attention. God takes away my security, He gets my attention. Because all of a sudden, I've got nowhere to turn. I remember as a junior in high school, God had to get my attention. It was in a soccer game. We were down at Maranatha Baptist Bible College. It was the last game that I was going to play in the season. There was more of the season to play, but I wanted to get some work in before winter came. We were building a house, and so it was the last game I was going to play in. And we were down. It was a Friday. We were playing the last game before the championship games, and we were down to a minute and a half left, and we were tied. We were down. The ball was at their end. I was playing halfback at the time, and I was going up to take a shot on goal. And a guy comes, and he runs into me from the side, and my leg went out just kind of sideways, did kind of a 90-degree angle in the way it's not supposed to turn. And I tore my ligament at that point as a junior. Fell down. There was no whistle blown. Everybody's yelling, "Get up! Get going!" I'm hobbling. I'm running down the soccer field. I said, "Coach, you got to pull me out." He says, "For crying out loud, there's 1 minute left. Stick it out!" Okay. That night, man, my goodness, I did not sleep. My leg swelled up twice the size of a normal leg. Came back home, and Mom says, "I'll bet you broke it." I said, "Mom, don't be such a mother. Just it'll settle down. Let me work with it." A month later, it finally was working. Okay, basketball practice starts. I go to the very first basketball practice. Everybody's out there. They're starting to warm up. You know, coach is still in the locker room. I go for my first layup. I go up. I come down, and I just keep going down. My leg just folds like a bowl of jelly. Well, maybe there's something wrong. God had to get my attention because over the course of the next 6 months, God said, "You know what? You've been living for sports. You've been living for your glory. You've been living for you. You've had a God that has a small g, and that's what you've been pursuing all of your life. Let me introduce you to me. Let me introduce you to a life that's far bigger than you." And that's what God had to use in my life when He took away my comfort, my security. It was at the end of that summer that God put me on a missions trip down in Arizona, and He called me into ministry through that. But you know what? God uses discomfort and insecurity to get our attention. Do we like it? No. Is it the direction that we would turn? Absolutely not. So who has to turn us there? God has to. Aren't you thankful that He does? Well, after the fact, yeah. In the middle of it, not really. A second way that God gets our attention is by confronting us with some rather shocking terminology in verses 6 through 17. The method that God uses at this point is accusation. They get down to Egypt, present themselves before Joseph, and Joseph says three times, and he implies a fourth time, "You are spies! You're spies! You're spies!" Verse 9, verse 14, verse 16. He kind of emphasizes what he means by that in verses 9 and 12. "You're spies who have come to seek out the nakedness of the land." Remember, they're into the famine now. They've had the 7 years of great abundance, unprecedented abundance. And now, Egypt, like all the nations around them, is experiencing a famine that's rather severe. There's nothing left. In fact, when God presents it to Pharaoh, he presents these ugly cows. And Pharaoh says, I've never seen cows so ugly. In all the land of Egypt, you can't find ugly like I saw ugly in my dream. This is a stark famine. And Joseph says, you've come to seek out the barrenness. The nakedness is the word that he uses. It implies that they have come to molest, that they have come to violate, that they have come to exploit them in their vulnerability. The accusation speaks in terms of gazing upon one who's helplessly exposed. They go to pains, to great pains, to say, listen, we're not spies. We've never been spies. It wouldn't ever even cross our mind to be spies. Let us tell you who we are. We are honest men. Okay? We know the story, don't we? We've read the past few chapters. So when they say they're honest men, we kind of fill in the blank, don't we? Honest men. Wink, wink. And that's how we're supposed to hear it. Don't accuse us of being molesters, of those who exploit the vulnerable. Now, wait a minute. Though they're not spies, they've proved themselves to be ruthless in their exploitation of one who is most vulnerable, haven't they? We would never think of doing that. That's gross, especially when you put it in that kind of language. To be so self-consumed, to take advantage of one who has no recourse to help themselves. The result is fear and self-justification. Verse 10, verse 11. No, my Lord, we are honest men. This theme of being honest men becomes a primary theme. We see it in verse 16, verse 19, verse 31, verse 33, verse 34. We're honest men. We're honest men. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We're honest men. Joseph says, okay. Though included in the covenant community, these men are not at present honest men. So Joseph designs a test for them in verses 15 and 16. A test that will verify. The word is to prove faithful the words that they speak. We are honest men. Let's see. If you are honest men, you say so, but is it so? And Joseph designs a test, a proof for them. Ironically, as they try to explain who they are at present, their current identity, verse 13 says, we are your servants. We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. Who are you? Who are you? Well, let me tell you who I am. And in saying that I'm not what you think I am, let me tell you who I am. They're forced to deal with their past. We're 12 brothers. They're 10. He's going to figure this out pretty quick. One's at home, and one is no more. And Joseph doesn't ask why. Joseph knows why. They're speaking of him. But interestingly, God forces them at this point to deal with their past. God deals with us largely the same way he deals with these guys. When we read stories like this, we tend to think of ourselves as the good guy, the guy in the white cap. The guy riding the white horse, or at least not the black one anyway. We tend to think of ourselves as sub-heroes in the story rather than the dirty, ugly, rotten guys. These guys are forced to deal with who they are really at heart. We're honest men, really. Okay, that's what we need to find out. And the problem is that you're not. The problem is that though you're not spies, technically, you are those who are accustomed to seeking your own self-interest at the expense of those who are most vulnerable. That's the real problem. That's what the issue is between me and you
God says, you know, before we can take our part within the covenant community, especially to experience God's blessings, we too need to be confronted with some rather shocking terminology. We need to be confronted with the blatant reality that we ourselves are seeking our own self-interests, seeking our own self-glory rather than the glory of God. We're forced to deal with this term called sin. We're forced to deal with this issue of small g, gods. Gods that sit on the throne of our hearts that we wouldn't necessarily call gods, but God has to pull back the curtain in our lives and expose us and say, you know what? You know what you've got on your heart? You've got a God. And that God can take any shape, form, substance. Sometimes we are the God on our own heart. Sometimes it can be like it was for me, sports. It can be entertainment. It can be fun. It can be fame. It can be possessions. It can be whatever our heart lusts for. It can be an experience. It can be a possession. It can be a position. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life. And God has to say, you know what? Let me pull back. Let me cut to the quick here. You've got a God on the throne of your heart, and it's not me. That's the real problem. This enthronement of something other than me, I have to call sin. And you say, I've got lots of reasons that that's my primary interest. And God says, I'm not interested in the reasons. I'm interested in the problem, and I'm interested in the solution. The problem is, I'm not there. The solution is, I need to be there. And so God has to introduce us using language that we wouldn't choose to use, but language that's 100% accurate. God has a way of designing tests to prove what we really are. You know, the saying goes, difficulties don't always make the man. They simply reveal who he is. That's what's happening with these guys. And Joseph is designing a test for them that doesn't just let their words speak, but lets their lives speak. And God has a way of putting you and me into the crucible in such a way that our actions will be revealed. And the real me must stand forward. That's what God does for us. Number three, God gets our attention by reminding us that everything, that is everything, is really about Him. Verses 18 through 28. The method God employs at this moment is some harsh treatment. We see up in verse 7 that as they come there, Joseph sees his brother, he recognizes them, but he treats them like strangers. It says he speaks to them harshly. He treats them in the same way that they treated him as a brother. He knows they're his brothers, but he treats them like they're strangers. I don't know you. He doesn't let any of his compassion shine through at this moment. Not because he doesn't have it. In fact, later on, we're going to see that he weeps as he listens to their story and he puts things together as he still has a longing for a relationship with these men. But he's treating them a little bit the way that they had treated him. As the story begins up in verse 3, it goes out of its way. Jacob sent, it doesn't say his sons in verse 3, it says he sent Joseph's brothers. These are the brothers of Joseph. These are the ones who worked against Joseph. These are the brothers who didn't treat Joseph like a brother. And all of a sudden, they're not treated like a brother. Joseph puts one brother in bondage, while the rest of the brothers walk away with their money. That sound familiar? Maybe let's not kill him. Let's just sell the kid. Oh, there we go. Now we all got, here's a little bit. Here's two pieces of silver for you, two for you, two for you. 20 pieces of silver. One brother's in bondage, and the rest walk away with their money. Joseph designs this test to bring up a poignant memory for his brothers. It says in verse 24, he takes Simeon. Why Simeon?
We're not told. Perhaps Simeon was a little more ruthless than the others. Maybe he needed more of a lesson. Maybe he seemed less repentant than the others. We're not told exactly why. Maybe it was that Simeon, nobody really cared for him. So maybe he was the least likely that they would come back and get. Maybe they would just leave him to rot. I don't know. We're not told why Simeon. But for some reason, Simeon's the one that stays behind while all the others go. The method that God chooses at this point to get their attention is this harsh treatment. And what happens as a result is that, again, they experience fear. But a fear that isn't self-motivated at this point, a fear that is more God-conscious than anything else. We see in verses 21 and 22, there's a fear for the past. They said to each other, "We saw the distress of his soul. We didn't listen. That's why our distress has come upon us." And God is making them hurt at this moment. Not because Joseph is vindictive and trying to get back. He's trying to prove who they are. He's trying to bubble to the surface. What is the real character of these men? He wants not just a reunion with them. He wants restoration. He wants to be brought back into fellowship with these men. But he can't unless he sees that there's a real repentance. And so he's bringing that to the surface. And all of a sudden, as the screws are being turned tighter on their lives, God has their attention. He says, "You know what? Our past is haunting us. We saw him in distress. We didn't think of his distress. We loved our money. We laughed at him. We were insecure because he said he was going to be bigger than we were, his big brothers. We didn't care a lick about him. That's why this distress is coming on us." Reuben says, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against him? But you didn't listen." Reuben makes an important point at this point. He says, "Listen, the way we treated our brother was sin. It was sin. We shouldn't have done it. It's not just that it was a nasty thing to do. It's that it was wrong." I don't know if you ever excuse yourself for doing something that was nasty. I used to like the word, I'm not bad, I'm mischievous. That sounds a little more fun and frolicsome. He says, "You know what, guys, we sinned. This just wasn't good. This was bad, what we did." Interestingly, he says, "We didn't listen. You didn't listen." And in the background, verse 23, Joseph is listening, and he hears this whole thing taking place. There's a fear for the past. There's a fear for the present. Verse 28, they're on their way back. One brother stops to feed his donkey. He opens his pack and, "Wait a minute. This is more than what I bargained for. This is the same money I just brought down to eat. Wow. Oh, stink." And all of a sudden, there's a fear in the present. I like how one commentator said, "The rest of the way back to Canaan, they were looking over their shoulder for a chariot with blinking lights." That's a joke. They didn't have lights on chariots back then, all right? There's a fear for the present. They're in real trouble, but there's a fear for the future. Because all of a sudden, this test that's supposed to prove that they're honest men, now they're stuck with their money that they brought to pay, but they didn't really pay. How do you explain that one? Not only do I not pass the test, but I fail it really, really bad. There's a fear for the future. It's interesting the shape that this fear takes. Verse 18. Joseph had proposed to them a first suggestion. "Listen, I'm going to keep all of you. One of you goes back and brings your brother. Sit in the prison for 3 days and think about it. On second thought, after 3 days, I'm going to send all of you back home to bring your brother. One of you is going to stay here. Here's why I'm going to do this," verse 18. Joseph says, "Because I fear God." Listen, let me tell you, I'm concerned about your families that are going to die if they don't get food. There's 10 of you. Why don't 9 of you bring back food for your obviously large families? I'm concerned about them. He says, it's interesting how he says it
actually for us. Is it verse 17, verse 18? Yeah, verse 18. Do this and you will live. End of verse 20. So that you shall not die. Joseph says, here's why I'm doing this. So you can live, so you won't die, so your families can have what they need in the middle of this hungry famine. I'm concerned about you. I'm concerned about you, even though I think you're spies, because bigger than you is my God. And they're being told this by what they think is an Egyptian. For all they know, he's using the generic term for God or gods. He might be talking about the sun god, the crocodile god, the snake god, whatever god he's talking about. But all of a sudden, they're cut to the quick. He's doing as a pagan what I'm supposed to be doing as a believer in the one true God. Wow. Man, now all of a sudden God has their attention. Verse 21. You know what, guys? The truth is, the honest truth is that we're not honest men. The honest truth is that we're guilty. Guilty before a sovereign God. Verse 22. God will require a reckoning for the blood that we have shed. For all they know, Joseph's dead. They really believe it. But they know that they can't pull a fast one on God. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also. You know what, guys? God is catching up with us today. That's a scary thought. They stop on their way back. They open up the bags. They find the money. You see what the question is there in verse 28? What is this that God has done to us? God is getting us. God is catching up to us. God is the one who's hemming in our path at every side, and everywhere I turn, I find nothing but God. And they're scared. But God isn't turning against them. God is bringing them back to Him because He loves them. And He's hemming them in on every side, and He's scaring them to death. It says, they trembled when they turned to each other and said, God's at work. And God is bringing them back. That's what conscience does for us. Oh, how much better it is that we acknowledge God sooner than later. Remember Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. And He'll make your paths straight. He'll direct your paths. The book of Philippians chapter 2, verses 9 through 11, after that beautiful passage of humbling of Jesus, even unto death, death on a cross, it says, wherefore God also hath highly exalted Him, given Him a name that's above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee will, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. To the glory of God the Father. One day, everyone must acknowledge that Jesus Christ, that God the Father, is all in all. It's going to happen. Wouldn't it just solve a lot of problems if we made that conclusion today? But we don't. And God has to slowly hem us in. Finally, God gets our attention by making things worse before He makes them better. This isn't our favorite point, okay? We want God to make things better before they get any worse. Interestingly here, the method that God uses is blessing. You see, back up in verse 19, Joseph could have kept all but one. Instead, he releases all but one. God was blessing these men. This means that more can be carried back to their families. He demonstrates a concern for their life. Back up in verse 25, Joseph could have kept their money. Instead, he returns their money to them. In fact, verse 35 says he returned it to all of them. Joseph didn't need money. He didn't want money. He wanted his brothers. He wanted a relationship. Verse 25, Joseph could have filled only their bags. Instead, it says he filled their bags and he gave them enough for the journey home too. More than what their money would have bought, he gave them extra, even for the journey. What I find interesting at this point is that Joseph could have revealed himself at this moment. But instead of just a reunion, Joseph wanted reconciliation. And so Joseph holds back on the temptation to say, guys, it's me. Hey, guys, remember Joseph? He holds off and he's willing to wait. He's willing to wait longer. And all of this is really a blessing. It's not working against them. God is working for them in the middle of this. But the result is that they have, again, fear. Fear mingled with self-pity. Jacob, now in verse 35, they go back and they tell Jacob the whole story. They get done with the story in verse 35. They start unpacking their bags. And all of them find their silver. And it says, all the guys are afraid. And Jacob joins them in their fear. They're afraid because of their sin. And because of their sin, they can't properly interpret God's blessing. This blessing looks to them like something that's ensnaring them. It's what Titus chapter 1, verse 15 says, to the pure, all things are pure, but to the defiled and the unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their minds and their consciences are defiled. Jacob blames his sons then at this point for his cumulative losses. Verse 36, he says, Joseph's gone. Simeon's gone. And now you want to take Benjamin from me. You guys keep taking from me everything that I have. And he blames his sons for his cumulative losses, both the actual losses of Joseph and Simeon and the anticipated loss of Benjamin. This is a common characteristic of self-pity. I don't know if you've ever had a vehicle that hasn't worked well for you. You've brought it in, they fix the problem, you bring it home, and they either didn't fix the problem or a new problem arises just as you get it home. So you bring it in, and you bring it home, and you guys are smiling like this has happened to you too, okay? It happens to me. What happens at that point? Well, I'll bring it home again, and we'll see what else is broken. Right? You ever say that? Why do you say that? Because we're good at the spiritual gift of self-pity. We're having a pity party. We're acting like a three-year-old.
Probably not going to work this time either.
That's exactly what Jacob's doing. Everything in life working against me. In fact, this is he's at the center. His focus is on himself and all of this. He starts out, he says, me, you have bereaved. He ends his little tirade, his tantrum there with, I have to bear it all. All of this bad stuff happens to me. Who does he sound like? He sounds like my little brother, right? My little sister. He sounds like my husband on his day off. Okay. It sounds like us at our worst. God is just revealing the ugliness of us. Reuben adds to the difficulty of the moment by adding insult to injury. He says, why don't you put Benjamin into my hands? Again, that theme of putting, entrusting something to me. Reuben had earlier in the story, back in chapter 35, verse 22, he had taken the initiative to try to establish himself as prominent within the family. At this moment, he's not even trusted with the life of his youngest brother. He says, if you trust him to me, if I don't bring him back, Dad, you can kill my two boys. What? They're my grandsons. Why would I do that? The scene closes then with Jacob turning to his son and says, he will not go with you. And here's why. Jacob adds at this moment to the jealousy by favoring one son again above all the others. Selfishly, Jacob clings to one more thing that he can't afford to lose, Benjamin. Isn't that why this problem started in the first place? Why is Joseph down in Egypt? Because daddy loved one boy rather than the rest of them. He loved him more, and this boy thought he was going to be special. He thought he was special. He is special. He's going to be special. But that's why they sent him away. And Jacob continues the problem. There's a problem going on here. The beautiful thing about this story is that it's not primarily a story about the characters involved in this story. It remains, as all other stories in the book of Genesis, a story about God, a God who desperately wants to bless his people so that God can use his people to in turn be a blessing to others.
This story remains the story of a people who repeatedly turn from the God who designed them for His blessing, but a people who will not be abandoned by their good God, one who's promised never to leave them nor forsake them. Instead, God pursues a relationship with His people, one that, because we are made in His image, possessing true freedom of will, it must be a genuine relationship. Consequently, God does not compel us to come, but He does make us willing to come. God's work of conscience may be slow, but it proves to be an effective grace. You know what? So often, our conscience starts to work, and what do we want to do? We want to run away. We want to run away. Don't run away from what God is using to draw you to Himself. Don't run away as God uses your conscience to draw you back to Him.